You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is Episode 4. Today, I'm talking with Professor Charlotte Slay. She's an honorary professor at UCL. She also is STS lecturer in the Social Studies of Science. Charlotte's one of our newest members of staff, and she has a long and distinguished career as a historian of science. She's an expert in the cultural history of animals. She also is a big name in the study of science and literature. Charlotte is co-author of the book Human, published in 2020 and co-written with Amanda Rees. That book is this year's selection for the STS One Book Program. You see, each year we pick one book that we ask our whole community to read. This helps us think together, and it helps us talk together. It also helps us with the interdisciplinary skills we all hope to keep sharp. I asked Charlotte if she would talk about Human in advance of a big event we have planned in STS for the One Book Program. I wanted to know why she and Amanda wrote the book, how it fits into her wider interests in the history of science, and how do we make use of some of the book's biggest ideas. We're talking over a telephone line. I started by asking Charlotte simply to introduce herself.
Hey Joe, it's great to be here. So my name is Charlotte Slay. I've been a scholar in STS and the history of science for 20, 25 years, something like that now. I joined UCL just this year, which I'm really, really excited to do. It's the first time I've been in a really big department that's completely devoted to STS. So that's super exciting for me. I guess I've been a little bit of a butterfly in the kinds of things that I have researched through my career so far. I started off working on the history of natural history and animals, which I think we're going to talk a bit about today. And along the way, I've also got drawn into questions about how literature and science connect to one another. From there, I kind of lily pad hopped to questions about art and science. I've done a couple of projects with artists, which have been really exciting. And I've gotten interested in science fiction, which I guess is also something that's come out of the literature theme. And like everyone else, I guess the environmental catastrophes that we're facing at the moment are something that have shaped my recent research. So yeah, a whole bunch of things. I mean, that's one of the things I love about STS is it allows you to reach out into all these super exciting and important areas of research, things that connect to so many areas of our lives.
One of the things we want to talk about today is the one of the books that you've co-written with Amanda Rees. It's called Human. It came out in 2020, a reaction book, and it happens to be the STS One book. So congratulations for being chosen as the STS One book.
Thanks so much. I'm super excited and really chuffed that you've chosen the book.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant book. We're going to talk a lot about it in the next 10 minutes or so. But Charlotte, can you please just give us a quick précis of what this book is about for someone who hasn't read it yet?
Yeah, I mean, it's an absurd book in a way. It's quite a small book. And if you pick it up and then, you know, half of it is pictures. So to sort of try and summarize what humans are in what, less than 200 pages is kind of crazy. And that's sort of the point of it. The way we decided to tackle this question of Homo sapiens and humanity, not necessarily the same thing, was to ask, what are the things that humans often compare themselves against? What are the things that we say, well, humans are a bit like that, but they're different in this important respect. So looking at the beings, the entities that kind of help us sharpen up our sense of what humanity is. So we picked, well, we had a lot of fun and we sank a lot of glasses of wine trying to decide what our categories should be, things that humans kind of ping themselves off for their identity. And we came up with animals, hominins, machines, females, gods, and aliens. So each chapter is devoted to one of those categories and the way it sharpens up our sense of what humans are because of what they're not.
I think what I really like about this use of contrast is it immediately stops you trying to think about essential things of humans and then think of all the, but what about, but what about, but what about. And now you've opened up a whole new way of thinking about contrast. So the animal versus humans, that's a one that I suppose is a really nice starting position for most people. And then you look at fossils versus humans. That's really a good one too. Machines versus humans. I think those three categories, when I first looked at the book, I thought, yeah, okay, this is good going. I warmed up now. You know, you've got me through a third of the book and I'm ready to pick up big ideas. And then pow, you've got a really great thought-provoking chapter, which is titled She. And it immediately gets you stopped to think, well, yeah, the archetypal human gets to be male so many times. And then by drawing she as a contrast, you really open up that question of why is it that way and who chose that and how can it be different? What do we get from thinking about it differently?
I really like the way that you've kind of understood the sneaky path that we take you on in the book. So we start with a couple of categories that seem kind of quite reasonable for us to compare ourselves against. Well, you know, why are we different from animals? And those are things that, you know, theologians and scientists have debated over the years, exactly as you say, kind of looking for, well, what is this essence of humanity that distinguishes us from that group? And it sort of seems reasonable, possibly, with respect to those two categories. Then we hit you with she, we hit you with female. And exactly as you say, you know, the default human is sort of defined as male. I mean, it, you know, it's a cliche, isn't it? But it's true that you get to medical textbooks and all the kind of pictures and the descriptions are of the male body. And then there's a final chapter which is about female anatomy, meaning gynecological anatomy, and that it's like the female is just kind of tacked on the end. It's sort of the special part of the human. And we see that even in the history of academia as well. Whatever the field, you know, be it literature or history, historically, as women have entered those disciplines, they have typically done women within whatever, you know, women in history, women in literature, female writers or whatever. It's like there's a sort of a special corner for women to talk about women, but basically humanity is male. So what we're trying to do in that chapter and by having it there in a sense is to blow open all of those other categories that the reader may have taken for granted, that there is something special that separates humans from animals, because we see that the kind of intellectual work that we do to accomplish that, it looks pretty thin when we look at it in the context of females. And again, later in the chapter Alien, we open up race in relation to those kind of moves. So when you go back then and think about the early chapters, hopefully the reader will think, hang on a minute, maybe those were invalid or unhelpful moves to make with regard to animals as well.
And it makes me think, what am I missing from the basic assumptions that I might bring into a conversation of thinking about what is human? I literally went back to the first three chapters and looked at them again to think about, now my frame of reference has changed. What do I see different that I missed the first time around? So that is so exciting.
Hey, Joe, you're just totally a dream reader. That's amazing that you did that.
And then you hit me with something else, which I thought was brilliant too, which was when you talk about God and the divine and the contrast between that and humans. And you get into what is a really familiar conversation in STS, which is about transhumans. So something like adding a bit of technology to humans to amplify us in one way or another. And you raise lots of other options that we have for thinking about humans and change. This kind of heads us towards the conclusion of your book, which I thought was really, really, really fantastic. And I hope when we get to One Book events in the department, department, we get students talking about this as a as an option for a way of thinking. And that's your idea of the M-human or M-humanism, as you talk about it. Maybe I can ask you to summarize what you're trying to get across with that idea of M-humanism.
You know, as we've been discussing, the whole trajectory of the book is that the more you drill down and try and define what it is that is the essence of humanity, the more you get into trouble, the more it seems to evaporate. If we take the example of animals, the whole trajectory of the science of animals is that the more we look, the more we realize that animals are extraordinary and do many of the things that we think of as special to humans, and indeed do, you know, things, many things that humans can't do. So when we drill down and try and find that core, it just kind of the more you turn up the microscope, the more it seems to fragment. And not only that, the second really key point that we make chapter after chapter is that when we do that work of saying this is an other type of thing that defines what humans are, for some reason, and we never really address the question of whether that's inevitable or not, but for some reason, when we do that, we sort of bracket off some members of our own species as less than fully human. You know, historically, it's something that we've seen again and again, that certain humans are demoted to the position of being merely like animals, merely brutes, not fully human, and therefore it's okay to not treat them as fully human. So not only is it not possible to define an essence, for some reason, when you try and do that, you end up doing an injustice or something quite horrible to certain members of the same species. So it seems like a really, really unproductive and possibly bad thing to do.
I guess if I had to explain this to my dad, I would say, and you tell me if you think I've got this right, that the default line of argument here is, rather than say no, say yes. So when you're thinking about, you know, is this a human, you should default by saying yes and then explore what the consequences of that are, rather than default to say no and then start separating out, because we know we make mistakes. Do you think I got enough of that to work with there?
Absolutely right. Yeah. So that's exactly what M-humanism proposes that we do. That I really like that formulation of it, that we start by saying yes. So the notion of M-humanism is that humanity isn't something that can be located within some beings and proven not to be in others. It is actually something that happens in relationship or in the moment of relationship. It doesn't have an existence other than in that sense. I guess if you wanted the really simple version, it would be to say, you know, let's start by saying yes, and then that other being is human, and then kind of see where we go from there. So perhaps the slightly more complex version of it is to say that the humanity exists in that moment of saying yes. And in some senses, this is not that much of a new idea. So we go back through some really interesting scholarship that came out over 50 years ago, I think, a wonderful, wonderful article that everyone should read called Should Trees Have Standing? And it's written by a legal scholar. And it's about whether trees should have standing within law, whether personhood, legal personhood, should be conferred to them. It's an utterly, utterly brilliant article. So that was, in one sense, one of those moments where you realise that, gosh, there's been a lot of smart people in scholarship, and loads of great things, you know, to go back and be rediscovered. But, you know, in this moment of ecological catastrophe, that imperative, I think, to say yes is all the stronger. And it's good not just for practical reasons, but I think it's just good for us to say yes and not no.
I think that that's a fantastic way to change the default. It'd be fascinating to see a lot of students run with this idea in projects, for example, thinking about ape humanity. Do human rights extend to primate? Do they extend to, in that example, trees? Do they, an example in the book, you talk about in New Zealand, various communities giving personhood to landscape features like rivers and things like that. And it's wonderfully eye-opening just to give it a go. Even if you profoundly disagree with the idea at first pass, give it a go and see how far you can get. I think that's a beautiful exercise in how STS promotes critical awareness of where you stand, no matter where you stand, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I kind of got myself in the process of doing this. So the chapter, in a sense, that I'm least happy with, and kind of is like a little stone in my shoe, is the one on machines, right? So that's the one where I get stuck. There's something in me that just profoundly rebels against the idea of sort of robot dogs in an old people's home. You know, if I'm an old person in an old people's home and someone gives me a robot dog to come and make me feel better, you know, that's going straight out of the window. But, you know, I feel challenged by my own thinking, which is a nice position to be in. Perhaps, you know, what would happen if we extended humanity to AI, to robots, to automata? Where would that put me? And, you know, and I'm aware that there are profound cultural differences in the way that people respond to these kinds of creations. So in Japan, for example, there just isn't the same sense of uncanniness that people in this country will typically have when they see a humanoid robot. That's really interesting and challenging, I think. Perhaps am I diminishing my own humanity by drawing the line at AI?
Excellent question. I think what we can do is set the students to talking about that and come back to you at an STS event and see what they think. I mean, you raised the point that technologies in different parts of the world are structured with different cultural values embedded in them. So the robots of fantasy films from California are really different than robots that are on the ground in Tokyo. And what we see so little of is the intercultural transfer of those things. How come we don't get those robots running around London so that we can understand what designers are trying to do? The real question is about sharing and comparing rather than just sticking with our own preset views on what these objects are supposed to be.
I mean, this is a whole nother conversation, I think, potentially, isn't it? But I think there's something really interesting happening where we've got AI developing on the one hand, and then we've got these embodied robots on the other hand, which we take to stand for AI. I think we kind of conflate them in some ways, you know, and in some ways, obviously, they are connected because there's sort of the learning processes that these sort of, you know, humanoid or dogoid robots have are sort of embed some of those processes. But the AI that runs the algorithms that link us all up around the world, the search engines, that all of that, those are transnational. And yeah, they kind of have a different being and a different purpose from these kind of self-contained little objects that we look at and then we ask ourselves, oh, do I find that cute? Do I find that scary? It's sort of, you could analogize it perhaps to, you know, there are these sort of huge religious systems, but then what you get is a cute baby Jesus in the manger. What relation is that supposed to bear to this kind of whole substructure that's hidden elsewhere?
I was thinking about the example we used to give in philosophy of biology class all the time as a debate, which was, are computer viruses alive? You do exactly what you do in this book, where you say the road a lot of people go down is start to think not, where they're not this, they're not that, they're not something else. But then inevitably somebody comes along and says, but let's go the other path. Let's say yes rather than no, and bring them in and see what we get out of that. That gets us closer to thinking about algorithms, I think.
Yeah.
Let's talk more widely about where this book fits into your research interests and your own background. The first thing I noticed when looking at the book is I open up the first page and I see the list of books already published in this series. And I count 95 animals or 95 organisms for which there are individual books made. And you have written several of them. So you want to start off there and talk about maybe other books in the series and then launch into talking about how that fits into your own research interests?
I was kind of sorry that we didn't manage to make human number 100, but maybe it's good. Maybe it's good for humans that we didn't have that kind of numerically magic spot. Perhaps that stops us having too much hubris. Anyway, what would a hedgehog care if it was 100 or 101? I don't think it would be that bothered, would it? The series has been going for almost 20 years now, which is pretty astonishing. And I actually wrote one of the first, I think it was four, that were published simultaneously. And that was about ants, which was actually the subject that I had done for my PhD in the history of science way back in the previous millennium. That book was kind of all the fun bits, all the bits that were too fun to be part of a proper PhD dissertation. So I took them all out and turned them into a really fun book with some pictures. That was, it's interesting. In some senses, although it was about animals, it wasn't animal studies, that book. It's cultural history, in the sense that it doesn't take ants for themselves or doesn't exactly tell ants' own story. What I was interested in was, how have humans seen ants? What kind of metaphorical frameworks have they imposed on them? And, you know, through the research for my PhD and a little bit after that, I sort of came up with three distinct phases that we've been through in Western science of looking at ants, or in the last couple of centuries. First of all, to see them as models for, you know, what is the simplest kind of mind we can imagine, like kind of in the wake of Darwin, and everyone is sort of going, well, okay, so presumably not just bodies, but also psychologies have evolved. Huh. So let's look at these creatures. They really complex behaviors, but they got tiny brains, and sort of trying to understand them as a model of psychology. And then kind of winding on into the 20th century, the interest becomes more in them as how they operate en masse, how they operate as a colony or as a society, and understanding social behaviors. And, you know, obviously in the light of fascism and communism, ants become either a really great model that humans should follow, or something really terrifying that we should avoid at all costs. So that's the sort of second frame. And then finally, in the post-World War II period, we see an interest growing in how ants communicate, and the concept of the transfer of chunks of information. How do ants transfer chunks of information? What is the format of that? And how does that build up into, again, a pattern that elicits a response? So there's a very clear connection with the unfolding thinking about computers and information networks and things like that. And latterly, there's been some quite interesting debates, essentially, that ask whether ants transmit data or metadata, which has been quite an interesting debate in myrmecology over the last couple of decades. So that was the story that I told through that research. I still think it's a really cool and interesting story, but it's very much a story about how humans look at ants rather than ants for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And how we use ants to think about ourselves, and we use ants to think about our own needs in the world.
Right, exactly. So as the previous couple of decades have gone along, and I've been to conferences about animal history and animal studies, I've seen this imperative growing to try and do animal studies not by humans for humans, but to try and do it somehow from the animal perspective, or to really engage with the wants, the interests of animals themselves. And I'm just perplexed by it. I'm just not sure whether it's possible or not. And in a sense, human was also a chance to think through that question. What would it mean to write a book about humans as though they were animals? Can we do that? Right. So this really extraordinary thing where humans are animals who imagine they're not animals, and now they would like to imagine that they are animals in order to write about animals. So we've kind of got ourselves stuck in this really weird loop. And if you kid yourself if you think you can write a book that your dog will be interested in. You really can't. Not unless you draw, sort of paint it with gravy, then your dog might be interested in it. We can only get at the interests of animals through our human goggles, if you like. Even though we are animals. It's so confusing.
It's a nice next step for cultural studies, where you're trying to get out of the mindset of the observer, and then you try to come back around to the observed. And it's because, of course, they don't have direct voice, it's very difficult. But at the same time, we're trying to get voice out of these organisms, aren't we?
Right. Yeah. So you're exactly right. So, I mean, the whole trajectory of STS and the history of science is to point out how observation, that sort of, or objectivity, those sort of crucial characteristics of science are highly problematic, because you're looking through human goggles and you're essentializing whatever you're politically or psychologically motivated to essentialize at that particular moment. So, you know, the whole point of our field is to sort of try and get out of that, try and be reflexive. But here's the weird thing. Maybe some scientists at least do that better than us. Animal conservationists, they do actually have a very, you know, close relationship, many of them, with the animals that they study, and they do sort of embed themselves in the same landscape, and have very often, I think, more emotional connection with the things that they study than comes out in the scientific publications that they produce. maybe scientists have been doing it really well in some senses. Perhaps we have actually some things to learn from them rather than to try and be objective about the scientists themselves.
If I've got this right, the difference between cultural history and sort of animal studies is cultural history is seeing animals from a human point of view, but asking how does culture and society and various, I suppose we would say now, biases filter our understanding of those organisms. And then animal studies is trying to go the next step, which is to turn that back around and to see the world from the animal's point of view as best we can, right?
You got it. You got it exactly, yeah. And we thought about, could we write human in that way? So we riffed on the idea that the publisher turned it down, but we riffed on the idea of having each chapter being a biography of humans, witting or unwitting, written by a different species. You might have a chapter written by a nit that just wrote about the ground that it lived on, never realizing that that was a human being. You could have a chapter written by an old salmon complaining about how the young salmons can't jump properly anymore, not realizing that, you know, the salmon leaps have been removed by human re-landscaping of the rivers or what have you. Or you could have a chapter written by an obvious one, a dog or a cat talking about how it had trained its human to respond to its desires. So, you know, we thought about trying to flip it around, and it would have been fun and may yet still be fun. Might end up writing it in some form or other. It's only a literary conceit. You're not really in the mind of a nit or a salmon or a cat. But maybe that's still a valid imhumanist move. You're kind of, well, let's have a go. Let's say yes. Let's do it. I just find this a perennially fascinating question. Is animal studies in the true sense possible? And what would it mean?
And one of the things I think you add nicely to this is your encyclopedic knowledge of literature and the arts that relate to animals. It seems to me every time I read something that you've written, I think, I haven't read that. I haven't read that either. How does she know all this stuff? And it just adds to the reading list of things to investigate. But the knowledge that you have of science and literature and the interaction between science and literature, I think this so beautifully connects up with exactly what you just said about, yes, it is a literary conceit to pretend that we know the mind of a gnat. But at the same time, you explored how people have given that conceit a go, and you've analyzed the results, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much richness there, isn't there? I was rereading Kafka's report to the Academy the other day, which is about a former ape who now considers itself human and sort of reporting to this anonymous, unseen Academy of Scientists how he made his transition. It's extraordinary. And you kind of read it and you think, well, we've kind of wasted our time in the last 50 years writing all these fancy books with isms and, you know, what have you. This is so subtle and so thoughtful and so sophisticated. I think, this has been such a fast-moving couple of years, I think, politically, ideologically, and in so many ways. Well, I mean, one of the things that has just hit me like a ton of bricks is how little I know, like literally nothing, about indigenous forms of scholarship and writing and understanding the world. On my long list of things I need to learn are indigenous tales about animals and humans. And I just don't even have the tools to know, you know, I can analyze a Western fairy story. I can have a go at Kafka. But, you know, I don't even know how I'm supposed to listen to a story like that, how I'm supposed to make sense of it. I don't even understand the forms of critique. What is critique for an Australian Aboriginal person? How do they chew stuff over? There's so much for us to learn. I just feel like the world has opened up for us as scholars over the last couple of years, and for us in the West. There you go. I've said us there as though I defined us. It's so hard to shake, I think, isn't it?
I was thinking while you were talking about this is a great interdisciplinary moment. Perhaps we need to bring in translation studies into animal history so that the scholars who have worried for many, many years about how to translate, say, medieval Arabic into 21st century British English, and all the arguments and fights about trying to capture the right voice and the right mindset, strikes me that this is heading into the same direction with animal studies. Do you think there's any potential there?
Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, weirdly, the fact that we as a human species are also potentially facing extinction, it kind of gives us a point of common ground where we can begin to understand animals. Because if there's one thing that sort of links us all, it's the desire for continued life. And that really harsh biological reality has sort of kind of come home to roost with us as a species. And perhaps that is a common ground to start from. But yeah, you're right. It's, you know, it's not just language, it's the whole form of life that makes sense of that language. And as we both well know, we're not original in making that point. It never goes away. It only becomes stronger, I think.
Charlotte, the other thing I wanted to mention is that you're currently serving as the president for the British Society for the History of Science. That is fantastic. It's much deserved. And it's an honor for the society that you said yes. So do you have any particular aims and ambitions for your time as president?
I'm so glad you mentioned that, Joe. Yeah, I'm so very chuffed to be president of the British Society for the History of Science. It's been a really important part of my career to date, and I know it has for many, many other people around the world. For me, the priorities for the society at this time, not just for me, for the whole of council and membership, is to embrace this moment that's been forced upon us in some ways of digital technologies. They're a great way to enhance the global conversation that we're having in history of science, to bring in those different perspectives from the global south, non-Western perspectives, and of course to cut our carbon emissions in the process because we don't have to fly. And the other big thing that I really am excited to do is to broaden the audience for history of science and STS. I think there's a great deal of public interest in popular science at the moment, and that's great. And I think that we can do a lot to convert that into an excitement about what we do as scholars, which is understanding the processes by which this scientific knowledge is made. So yeah, cutting emissions, broadening the conversation, and reaching out to bigger audiences. That's what I'm excited to see the society do.
That's really fantastic. And the festival last year was brilliant. And with another one planned in the works, that's something really exciting to look forward to too.
Yeah, watch out for this summer. There'll be something pretty cool happening again.
Charlotte, thank you so much for taking the time to have a conversation today. And we look forward to this upcoming STS One Book event. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe, for having me. It's been great to talk about the book, and I'm really looking forward to the event.
That's our podcast for today. Thanks to Charlotte for taking the time to chat. In the show notes, you'll find details for the book, for that reference about the standing of trees, and for the One Book program. That's been going for ages, and yes, you can join in on the fun too. Music today was from Kevin MacLeod, his work called Roland at Five. It's available from the website filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you're keen on the cultural history of animals or anything else in the broad range of STS, just get in touch. We're happy to talk, and there's always so much to learn. We'll have another episode soon. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out. Remember, in addition to our regular episodes like this one, we also have bonus episodes and career episodes that can pop up just about any time. So make sure you subscribe. That way, you won't miss out. Finally, you can find out more about the show, tell us what you think, and explore more about the programs we offer just by visiting our website. Here's the address, so write it down. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. Well, that's it for today. We'll meet here again soon. I'm Professor Joe Kane. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Follow us online at ucl.ac.uk forward slash STS forward slash podcast.